But today we have a special speaker, special in a couple of ways. Firstly, because she is our first graduate student in this seminar program. We have a few. We have another one coming up in a few weeks. Right? So she's our first graduate student. And also, Frances is doing something that is not often spoken about too much in these sort of seminars, the type of work that we do in digital humanities. Frances is working on your PhD, if I'm right, you're in the Department of English in King's College, and your thesis is on reception of Servius.
Yes.
That well-known 4th century grammarian, famous for his commentaries on Virgil's Aeneid. What's particularly interesting about Frances' approach is that she's looking at the user experience. Rather than talking about the back end and the wonderful technologies that go to build these resources, what she's actually looking at, if I understand correctly, is the user's appreciation of what's happening and how the user can engage with these texts online. So, I'd like to introduce Frances, and the title is A Digital... Oh, that was simple. I could have learned that. I didn't have to read it. A Digital Preservation...
Presentation.
Beg your pardon, these glasses. A Digital Presentation of the Text of Servius. Frances,
thank you. Thank you. Please feel free to interrupt or ask questions or comment or anything else throughout. Don't think I'm just going to sort of lecture. If you want to say anything, just please say and ask, especially while the images are up on the screen, because it's easier to talk about stuff while it's actually there. As the introduction said, I'm not looking the kind of what you call the back end kind of side of things, but I'm actually going to look at the perception and presentation of book and text and image. Right, this work forms only a small part of my PhD thesis, and it's really work in progress. As the introduction said, I'm actually doing a thesis on Servius in context and the reception of Servius in performance culture. So this is a tiny bit of it. And one aspect of what I'm looking at is the way in which both book and text and image were perceived and also were presented over the years. Servius, for anybody who either doesn't know me or doesn't happen to be a specialist in late antiquity, is identified as the writer of an extremely long and detailed commentary on Virgil's works, which hasn't been re-edited or printed in its entirety since 1881 and is not particularly easy to get hold of. There are a whole range of reasons as to why the text hasn't been reprinted or re-edited in its entirety, which people have written a great deal about, but what I'm looking at is one reason for this might be related to the perception and presentation of text. And what I'm concerned about right the way through is how text looks and how you perceive. All my slides are very graphic. They are to indicate the way in which you perceive the text, the way in which you look at the text. So actually background matters, which is why I was complaining at the start that I'm looking at the right colour and the wrong colour is on the screen. It is supposed to be much paler and less yellow than it is. So if anyone wants to look at the actual real colour output, please come and look at this computer screen because it does look different.
Much nicer on your screen.
Obviously I configured the colours to when I was sitting at a computer. And also to look at the way in which things have been laid out, the TypeScripts that I've used, and this sort of thing. Which is also why I said please interrupt while the slides are up there, because then obviously it can be commented on. For those people who have not come across reading bits of Servius, this is just an illustration of what an average comment from Servius might look like, as it's usually printed in the, I would say, recent editions, but when I say recent, we are talking quite old. The text in a kind of vacuum. We have a little quotation from Virgil, which they print in kind of small capitals, and then it's followed by the comment from Servius. Sometimes Servius's comments are only about a word or two long when he's just sort of glossing or re-explaining an individual word from Virgil. Sometimes they can be mid-length, like I've done here. There are a few comments that run to a whole page of A4 if you were to print it out in ordinary size 12 font. So there are some considerable variation in length. Also, they often contain references to other sections of Virgil, quotations from elsewhere, either in the same text as is being commented on or one of the other works, or even to other writers' works. So you've got loads and loads of cross-referencing all the time. And Servius, because he wrote a very long commentary on Virgil and therefore knew Virgil very well and expected his students and readers to know Virgil very well, doesn't necessarily tell you exactly where the tiny little quotations come from. Because obviously people tend to know that thing, don't they? So that's another thing that is an issue when you're actually looking at the text. There are a variety of different ways, can I throw the board marker? A variety of different ways in which things, such a text could actually be displayed. P.K. Marshall explains that he thinks it's never been proved exactly how the text might have originally been presented, whether it was originally presented in this kind of vacuum, or in different ways. What you could have is you could have exactly as I've written it out there, but you could also have several other things. You could have, I'm going to use capital letters as opposed to little squiggly things because I've only got one colour marker. You could have Virgil's text being presented on the page like this, and you could put Servius's text inside it as little comments. You could also have Virgil's text and then have Servius's text separately. I'll carry on with the capitals. You could also do something else and put Virgil's text in the centre of your page and put Servius's text all the way around it. All of these methods have been at some point or other published, produced, printed, written. You could also have masses and masses of Virgil and decide that all you want to use from Servius is a tiny little footnote. Or you could, in fact, switch that round, which is more or less what you've got there. Thank you. And because of all these different ways in which you can do things with the text, that means that it was also reused, adapted, changed, because if you're going to do one of these, you probably want a different amount of text on your page if you're going to match it up to Virgil. So by the end of it, you've got a great variety in the ways in which the text can be actually not just presented, but also the bits of the text that are going to be used. And each one of these versions gives a different balance to how, what you're reading. It encourages the viewer to read things differently. Because if you've got the one text, then the other text, you're reading one thing first, then focusing on the other. If you've got the two interleaved, you're encouraged to read the both things simultaneously. And if you've got one next to the other, again, you're being encouraged to read things in a different way. So in each case, not only does a layout prioritise one text over another, but it also encourages the reader experience to be somewhat different. You'll have to look at it on the screen afterwards. The colours are better. And it's not so yellow. This is an example of a page from the Vatican Virgil, which was probably around 5th century produced. And it's obviously a luxury prestige edition, but it demonstrates this idea that books are not just black and white. They're actually coloured with image, and the image and the text are actually merged together. Because not only have you got the scene being described in Virgil's writing, which I can even use the pointer, you can see there, but you've also got the scene being shown here. And unfortunately, there is no way on this projector you are going to be able to see this in any form of clarity, despite all my efforts to make this file enormous in size. There are names underneath each one of the little figures. So you've actually got text inside the image, as well as the image being incorporated with the text. And in this particular edition, at the start of every single book of the Aeneid, actually the first three lines of the text are written in a different colour, slightly larger, again, to make the way the text looks is a key to what the reader's experience is. Okay, this is a luxury edition and would have been really expensive, but this is also a high respect edition. This is an edition that was considered to be really good, as opposed to just brightly coloured book for small children or something. This is an example of this sort of thing. This, which is actually coming out reasonably legibly in comparison to what I had feared. This particular manuscript is, I've got the date somewhere, but probably somebody moved my stuff, so it's somewhere over there. But it's a 14th century manuscript. It contains some text from Virgil's Aeneid. Start of book four, and probably tell you the details of it. This is 14th century manuscript, I was correct. What you've got the beginning of the Aeneid in these in the sort of darker colour, and then you've got Servius's text or other commentary written in between and down the side and over the top of the other text. And here it's in fact important that you've got these two different colours as well as two different styles of handwriting in order to distinguish and be able to read one from the other, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to tell them very clearly. But again, the fact the two texts are merged, and they merge with this very nice large illustrated letter in order to bind the two as well. It actually takes a similar colour red from the commentary and uses that to incorporate and bring the two texts together. So again, you've got this kind of merging of what the text looks like. You can do it in print as well. This one, 1501, Sebastian Brandt did a very nice, very beautiful edition of Virgil's works, which the French National Library have very helpfully put online in PDF form. So you can literally browse through the whole thing, and it's really quite good quality. You can zoom in. And this page, which is from the middle of book one of the Aeneid, where Aeneas is coming in a magic mist, so he's actually invisible. He's coming into Carthage, and Dido sitting on her throne, looking out and being generally a good ruler at that stage. You've got the text of Virgil down the bottom here in this little block. Then you've got Sebastian Brandt claims to have five commentators. I haven't managed to find five, not least because one is one that we haven't got any text from. Charlotte is nodding at this point. If I said Aelius Donatus, he claims is one of them. Yeah. You've got these commentators all down the side here. They are indicated by an initial letter or a couple of letters. So just, just trying to find an S for Servius now, and I can't quite see it, but you've certainly got a C just there to indicate one of the commentators. I'm not going to find an S while I'm looking for it. So again, you've got text in the centre, you've got commentary text surrounding it, you've got illustration all on the same page. Potentially, if Sebastian Brandt had actually included all five commentators, you could have five commentary texts, one text of Virgil, text of the actual image itself, and sometimes the images contain little words. I think there's one in there. Because they tend to label their characters again. Plus you've got Sebastian Brandt's layout, so that's, I've lost count, I think, eight texts, one page. So again, a different kind of reader experience, exactly it is that you look at. And I haven't included this on the main slides, but I can bring it up if you want me to. The first page of the Aeneid from the edition that the French National Library have put on the internet has got the first few lines of, about three lines of the Aeneid, because there's so much commentary to go on the first line of the Aeneid that takes up the rest of the page. And where Virgil has started Arma Virumque Cano, Servius has written in the commentary downside somewhere, Arma id est bellum. And somebody who owned the book at some point obviously read the comment and took note of the fact that armour, bellum, so they took a pen and they wrote above Virgil's text where it says armour, they wrote bellum. So you've got another text on the page again. And they've obviously been reading this whole thing together.
Can I ask just very quickly, is it complete, the Servius edition?
No.
Okay. So it's
because, yeah, there's some points where you can actually tell that some of the stuff that's certainly in the more recent editions that we have as a so-called complete comment has been repeated by one of the other commentators. So the editor of this has just kind of taken the bits that aren't in the other commentaries that he's printing so as not to make his commentaries even larger. So again, we've got an example of how text and image are not separated. In this one, which is this one's a 15th century manuscript of Virgil's works. You've got yet another example of one of my illustrations of how you can present text. So you've got Servius's text at the bottom here. You've got Virgil's text here. You've got illustration here. But then you've got illustrated letter, which actually merges over into the image while the image in effect goes down because of the illustrated letter. Then you've got a different way in which they're presented. And all of this makes a really nice looking text. This is actually only half of the page. There was another column on the, I think it was on this side, which I've just removed because this was a different digital library which had helpfully put this up on the internet. But unfortunately the quality of the text is slightly blocky because they did a really good shot of the picture and the initial capital, and then the rest they did a really tiny one. So I sort of stitched them together nicely, but I can't get the text to quite equal the level of detail that the image does. But again, you've got image describing what's happening in the text. This is the beginning of book two of the Aeneid. They should actually be sitting in a banquet while Aeneas tells the story of the night all his friends were killed and his city was destroyed, but they seem to be sitting in a slightly more private space, interestingly, so you can get a bit of different interpretation going on there as well. This is the current state of the text, if there's anyone out there who feels like going to wade through it. You can get the 1881 copy, hard copy. About 20 university libraries in the country have it, and Cambridge University just put theirs in the Red Bookstream, so you can't borrow it from there anymore. You can get the PHI CD, which you need to load special software onto your computer in order to read it. You can get the Aeneid text only online at Perseus. And that's it for the entirety. And then the Harvard Servius project started in 1946. They did Aeneids 1 and 2 then. Then they did Aeneid 3, 4 and 5 in 1965, and they're still waiting for the rest. Some of them died, some of them are continuing, and when it was announced, when Gabby sent out the general emails announcing that I was doing this presentation, J.J. O'Donnell from America emailed me and said the Harvard Service labours on. Those are his words from his email. He didn't sound terribly positive about it. None of them have received terribly good reviews either. There were some really, really quite nasty reviews of the Harvard Servius, which Charlotte is nodding at, where it was strongly knocked back and criticised for having lots of errors in it. And if you don't happen to feel like wading through about 1,500 pages of Latin, which is what the full text amounts to when you print it all out on A4 paper, as I did once, with some help, then you can get Aeneid Book 4 in English. That's it. Nothing else. And my other supervisor, as opposed to the one who's in this room, has some not very pleasant things to say about this edition in English. So really, that's kind of it. This is what a page of the Harvard Servius looks like. It's not particularly readable, and that's not entirely the fault of the projector or any graphics. What they did is In about 1600, somebody produced a larger augmented version of Servius's text because they discovered extra stuff and they went, wow, there was much more of Servius's text than we originally thought. So it was Petrus Daniel in Paris published this augmented version. Everybody was terribly excited. But in the 1800s, somebody discovered that actually it wasn't a question of it being an augmented version of Servius, but rather that there was two commentaries that had been stitched together from all of this kind of procedure. So at this point, they decided that the other commentary would be the lost text of the famous commentator Aelius Donatus. So the entire of the Thilo and Hagen 1881 edition spends a great deal of time dissecting the difference between what would be the Servius and the lost commentary. So they put all the lost commentary in italics, mix it all up together with the plain text Servius. It was felt not to be quite adequate in terms of pulling things apart, so the Harvard Servius went a little bit further. They've got, and I can never remember which side is which, I'm afraid, but one of the sides of equal columns, you have to notice that you've got equal columns, you've got column going straight across, and you've got a two-thirds column as well. One of the equal columns, probably this side, is the text of Servius. The other one is the text with the lost commentary. This is stuff that's common to both. I can't honestly remember what the third one is. And then you've got all of this stuff at the bottom to explain all the different possible variations of how the text might possibly have been written at any particular given moment in time. This is magnificent if what you want to do is pull the text of Servius to pieces. It's not very helpful if you want to read it. Because apart from anything else, you've got to wade through 20 pages of introduction that they wrote in Latin. Well, actually, probably wrote it in English and translated it into Latin and then only printed the Latin. So anybody who actually wants to have a look at text of Servius, which they may well do to have a look at what a medieval writer might have done with it, got to wade through 20 pages of Latin introduction in order to work out what on earth bits of this they're supposed to read. And then, they haven't got access to very much of it, they've got to wade through this in order to work out what's going on. Now, all of this actually writes this text as not for being used, because it's quite difficult to do that, but it's just antiquarian, it's for analysis, it's for pulling it to pieces. So it can be used by people who've got lots of familiarity with Latin, are totally confident that they know the text of Virgil, because you've only got those tiny little quotations in the small capitals, so you've got to have your text of Virgil as well, you've got to go and look at, and then you've got to work out which column you're supposed to read at any given moment in time. Right, now I'm going to talk about the way things look. Basically, whenever you lay out a page, whenever you choose a way in which you're going to present something, the way in which you present it, how you present it, onto what script you use to present it, carry meaning. So you've got the difference there between a very ordinary sans serif font and a very ordinary serif font. The sans serif one generally is read as being kind of modern, clean lines, readability. You'll find things like exam papers tend to be printed in sans serif fonts, whereas a serif font is more traditional. This is a particularly traditional one. It's not the same as Times New Roman. And if you look at the capital T and H, they actually merge together, which is more like what you'd find in a printed book. And if anybody, one or two people here might do a walk ever from Liverpool Street to the Strand, they will walk through the City of London, which uses a serif font on its road signs because it's old, and City of Westminster, which uses a sans serif font, presumably to try and indicate it's up to date, maybe. I don't know. But again, you get different fonts carrying different meanings to them. When I showed this to a friend of mine yesterday, he looked at the first one and instantly remember the Lord of the Rings. So each of these fonts, that are actually, these ones are all based around various earlier scripts, though the bottom one is a modern reinterpretation of black letter. I do have a proper black letter one, but it won't embed properly in PDFs. So each one of these will carry different meaning, different significance, and you'd be fairly unlikely to read an academic article printed in Herculaneum. And this has been analysed in some detail by Martin Irvin, who looks at the ways in which different layouts, different typefaces, different ways of presenting text all signify different things about that text. And if you print it in a certain way, you make that text into something. So layout as well. This is the standard academic layout, all normalised, no variation, different from that earlier, those earlier books with all the colours and the different typefaces and the pictures all over the place. This is one continuous narrative. There's a footnote at the bottom, which is an aside, and any illustrations are on another page, probably at some other area of the book, or they're not included at all because it costs too much money. I'm not very happy with the next slide, I'm afraid, but it was the best I could do at the moment. We're actually used to reading texts in different formats all the time. We look at newspapers, encyclopedia, and we look at internet pages, which I might be able to bring up. Oh, it's gone loopy. There it is. There we go. Which, if anybody's from King's, they will recognise that very clearly. But you've got a mixture of different types of fonts, different colours, different texts, if it fitted on the page. And this is not a mouse with a wheel, so I can't go down very easily. But you've got continuous text, you've got all sorts of bits and links and other things going on. So we're used to reading these sorts of things, but perhaps perceive them in for particular texts. And in fact, the relationship between any of those given texts is going to say something about the way in which those texts relate to each other on the page, is also how they relate to each other in other respects. Digital text has some advantages. I did mention economic cost. If you want to produce nice, pretty pictures and lots of different colours and stuff, it's a lot cheaper to do it on a CD than it is to print it. And you also then don't have quite the hassle. I had trying to make a printed copy of this yesterday, and the background came out green on one printer, yellow on another printer, and brown on another printer. And now it's come out a funny colour on the screen as well. You can also have different variety in the ways the text is presented, so it can change around at different points. And you can hyperlink, which works really well for all of Service's points, where he suddenly quotes you one bit of Virgil and then a different Virgil or something else entirely different. You can hyperlink that all out, so you can select your bits and follow. You can still read the text 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or you can follow the arrows, or you can follow the colours. You can do various different things with it. So not only does that lead to a different way of reading, like a different reading pattern. Do you just read straight down the page, or do you follow the links? And what connections do you get there? And the reader takes a more active role, like you do when you read a page on the internet, and you choose which bits you're going to follow. But there's something else. When I show you in a second a couple of pages that I've got of Servius's text, it's actually a different criteria for selection. The Harvard editors are sitting there pulling out different bits of Servius and trying to find the lost text of Aelius Donatus, and that's their criteria for how they're presenting it, for what they're selecting. But I actually have to make very different decisions, because I wind up saying, well, I can't use that comment of Servius on the same page as this comment of Servius, because they don't fit. I've got a certain size page. I can produce so much text on any one page. So actually, I find in doing this, I have to make very different decisions about what it is I'm going to put on the page and why. And oddly enough, they're actually much more similar to the sorts of decisions that earlier copyists, editors, must have had to make. When Sebastian Brandt was laying out his page and you asked about whether the text was the full text, part of the reason is you saw how he had to get it all in to a nice square and fit it round the other text, so they're going to make decisions about what fits and what doesn't fit and where you shorten things and what you do with it. Now, this is the point where that, and hopefully coming up with this. I've got three pages of this, and by the end of my thesis I might have five pages, no more than that. It's a tiny portion of my thesis, as I said. It also takes quite a long time to produce. However, this is a sample of the sort of thing you can do. So you can move to the first comment that I chose, which, by the way, is because it was the right length for the page. That's how I started. I needed one that did the right kinds of things, and it had a quote, and it was the right length. Now, what I've actually done is, in order to give somebody the possibility of reading both Servius's text and the full augmented text, is this page has, in green, Servius's text, and it's translated. So anybody who doesn't feel like wading through a whole load of Latin, there it is. And then I've got the augmented text, not pulled apart, just all of it together, as it would have been printed originally, in blue on the other side of the page. And rather than just giving you the tiny little quote of Virgil, which is included here, I've actually given you the context. Because if I said to everybody, Aeneid book 4, line 261, you all instantly jump up and go, yeah, we know what that is, don't we, off by heart. So you've got enough there that you can actually make some sense of the comment. And that's meant to give an experience that's actually more similar to how that he might have originally looked at Servius 500 or years ago. And you can follow some links. This is how I decided what page to do next. I simply went to the next bit and followed the link. So you're actually getting a different way of reading the text because you're being encouraged to look at the points where Servius compares one thing to another thing. And I chose, this is why I'm making such a fuss about the background. The background I've actually chosen, which you'll have to look on the screen to see, is a much paler sort of creamy colour. It's meant to replicate kind of vellum, which, as you can see, hasn't come out there. I've chosen a typeface which is formal Roman style capitals for Virgil's text, but kept the English in a more traditional form that we might be used to. And I've kept Servius's text in the same form, largely for readability. This page is one which just has Servius's, no augmented text. So there I could include several comments by Servius, all on this little bit. And just to illustrate that I can put images into here as well, see if I can enlarge this so you can see what the image actually is. This is an image taken from I think it's 15th century, but I'm going to check. Yes, it is 15th century. Manuscript, and it's actually an image taken from the very first line of Virgil's Georgics, and it's a little picture of Virgil with corn round his head, but it seemed to be rather appropriate for a page that actually describes the winner binding their head with yellow plant, and is therefore kind of reusing of bits of images, which actually, again, was something that was done. We've got points where, in that Vatican Virgil, that image before, with Aeneas and the Sibyl, we've actually evidence that they drew around the edges of those and copied them into, I can't remember which version of the Bible it is, but they become a couple of saints in one of the editions of the Bible. So they get reused and adapted for different contexts. So that basically is it. And nobody has asked me, well, one person has asked me a question.
Sure, you're going to get many more, but thank you. That was very good. I have a question because my familiarity with Servius really, I guess, comes through Persius, because again, looking at the Persius text of the Aeneid, they have the little links where you click on where Servius gives a reference. So I have sort of, you know, dipped in and dipped out several years ago when I was looking at the Aeneid. But what I want to ask is you showed us a sort of 14th, 15th century printed editions. But do we have a manuscript tradition? What I'm thinking of is if we have a modern commentary, and it comes to mind is Austin, you know? Then you have the text, critical edition of the text, and then you have his line-by-line commentary, and that's how we sort of are used to picking it off the library shelf. But when, in Servius's time, I guess 4th century, so, I don't know, as an object, right, as an artifact, what would it have actually looked like? Would it have been just his comments, or would
that's
it have been?
We don't know.
critic. We don't have any manuscript tradition on it.
I think the earliest ones go back to about 9th century. So, 500 years out.
Well, that's a short answer to my question. I was thinking. No, I have no idea, as I said, because I've only come across it via Perseus. So, we don't have anything other than the Middle Ages printed book, the later printed book.
Well, either the printed or the manuscripts, but we don't have anything earlier than about 9th century.
Of the 9th century. And from in what? And that's in the form, the 9th century ones are in the format that you showed us.
They come in a range.
I understand that Servius, unlike, I mean, arrives as a commentary about the Virgil manuscripts, or just of Servius, which is rare in issue commentary. Then in Virgil manuscripts, you very often get bits of Servius stuck in the manuscripts.
That's how it appeared to be in one of those books. It sort of almost looked like it was a book, a printed edition of the Aeneid, and somebody had written in, Servius' bits in there. But that's not what happened. That was printed in that way.
It would seem to have been, according to the information I read about it.
Yeah, because I assume it has, because it worked very well with the little graphic, because it picked up on both colours.
Yeah.
I think that was very good. But it was almost as if it was produced to look like somebody had scribed.
It was certainly written in two different handwriting, possibly by two different people, but then the initial letter might have been drawn by another person as well, because sometimes the illustrator would have been different from the actual scribe.
There's certainly other numerous fragments, aren't there, which have commentaries. There may be no fragments of Servius, but there certainly are fragments which have other ancient commentaries of that sort of period on. I can't picture anything in my mind to think of comparisons. We must have primary text or commentaries that sort of thing.
Manuscripts that old. You're saying manuscripts that are that old with commentaries.
Well, bits of papyrus with
commentaries.
That sort of thing. I just can't picture anything like that.
It is quite unusual for a commentary to have such status that it's copied as itself,
as quite commentary,
rather than just running around the edge of the text. I was thinking, have you looked at the images that have now been of Homer that have recently been put up online but at the Centre for Hellenic Studies? And they've put up these wonderful images of one of the great Homer manuscripts. And that's very good for looking at the layout of commentary, and it's all there is. And that's the sad thing. You think, they took off the whole page, they've got all this commentary. You don't feel their hearts really in it. They just want to focus in on what's really important. But I suppose the existence of manuscripts where you merely a memo and then the comments, which is something you get, for example, in the philosophy commentaries, does that mean that's what people used in teaching? You've got Virgil, I'm teaching, I then explain to you from my copy of Servius what it is that you've got in front of you.
And
that's,
I mean, of course, with biblical commentaries,
yeah.
I was going to say, in the Middle Ages, that's exactly when we have that layout, world and commentary, that happens at university.
When you've got a big bunch of people.
So, yes, philosophy, law books especially.
Whereas
the
private scholar reads the beautiful book with the commentary around the edge, because he's on his own, and so he wants his commentary with his text. So there it could be quite interesting issues of use and audience.
Very harsh on the Harvard Servius in terms of layout. I always found layout the one good thing.
Quite difficult to read.
But I guess it depends what information you want to get out of it. It does. I mean, the final Haken is, I find, very confusing. I've never made it for the introduction, so I understand.
You haven't got any pages from that show?
No,
probably
I don't.
Probably in Google Book.
I don't think it is yet.
Just the kind of thing Google Book is for.
I want to say, you said, I think, you put a slide, and I couldn't really read it because there were different content for me, it was actually difficult to read it, but you said something like a digital medium facilitates a certain kind of reading experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right, but I also think that what I want to say is that I think sometimes we tend to set traditional medium, you can have so different, so many different ways of presenting a text and saying on the print. So you show, for instance, a critical edition that, in a way, makes the spirit of text in a certain way, but there are other types of
English
books that would simply take all of the things. So I think sometimes it would be easier, but it would be better to think in terms of format and layout rather than separate straight away into media. But that was just a point for now. The other thing I wanted to say is about your work here. I think you explained well, I think that your objective was to show how basically you can sort of reinitiate a reading experience that was possible in previous editions of the time and so on. But I'm a bit puzzled by it. I'm not sure. I mean, which is the text you're presenting? In a way, you are making your own edition, right? Because you're choosing, for instance, to show specific translation, or you're choosing to specific.
Yeah. Well, I had to translate it because there wasn't.
There wasn't a translation yet. So this is. I mean, in a way, the critical edition is a specific objective, which is the one of showing. You know, as you say, the analytic process, the fact that the text doesn't exist, and so we try to recreate it. But in this case, what are you really trying to do? Is it just a presentational feature that interests you?
Because
this is not an edition anymore, right? You're completely forgetting about all the how
I'm not even pretending to try and re-edit Servius from manuscripts.
Okay.
That's not even remotely where I'm coming from. I'm leaving to people who are much more experienced at that than me. I'm just literally looking at the way in which you can present a text of commentary in such a way that it is readable for a modern audience who don't necessarily have Latin but need to be able to have access to the Latin, to the Virgil, to everything, and to give them an experience that would be equivalent, as close as possible, to what the reading experience might have been for, say, somebody reading those illustrated manuscripts, everything on the page, but the whatever the language and the layout and so on. So that's what I'm trying to imitate. I'm not trying to replace the Harvard edition in any way whatsoever. I'm not competing with them.
The left and right, that's Servius, and then Servius Opus.
Yeah.
Right.
The green is Servius, the blue is
right. The
augmented, yeah.
Because, I mean, the thing I like about the Harvard edition is that you understand what's in both manuscripts, or both traditions. Would you be interested in integrating that into your project? Because here, I mean, we have some, obviously, that is on both sides.
Mm.
And, again, I would have to go back and say, well, what is on both sides?
Yeah, I mean, I included the both texts here as an example of a way in which you could have alternatives or two texts parallel. I mean, equally, it would be possible, say, to include more than one commentator on the same page for comparative purposes. And I'm sure this is possible, though I haven't even remotely tried to do it, that the user could then select which commentary they wanted to have displayed at any time.
Are you using kind of like CSS to do this, or is it you actually laying this out by hand and like so?
I'm doing it in InDesign.
Sorry?
InDesign.
InDesign, okay. So does that sort of separate? I mean, is that, I don't know InDesign, but it's that. Do you have the text and then that just gets automated? This process? No, you're actually laying this out.
InDesign is basically it's professional design software whereby you have a lot of control over the text. So you can actually control the way in which any given character on the page looks, where it sits, what the relation is to other characters on the page, to whole paragraphs. It gives me much more control than I would have in other. I did look at doing it as a web page, but the problem I had with the web page is that I didn't have enough control over where things sat, and they would keep on moving about in a way that I didn't like.
I'm really fascinated by this idea of the text. I mean, aside from the semiotic issues about how text and image is set, I'm wondering about this idea of not only recreating perhaps the kind of aesthetic experience of the medieval reader, but there's also this wonderful notion of infinite choice that's kind of embedded in this way of using text. And I guess my question is about your views on the aesthetic kind of level of this sort of work. aside from the particular linguistic concerns that one might bring to the Serbia's virtual relationship, this seems to be a kind of way of seeing as much as a way of reading. And perhaps you could just talk a little bit about how you see this fitting into our contemporary understanding of these texts, which seem to have such long tentacles of tradition of writing presentation. That's not a clear question. More just what your views on the kind of aesthetic nature of this particular.
Well, as I said, it was aesthetics that was governing a lot of the choices I was making about how to present it, because I actually wanted something that would look not just cool, but also visual in that way that those earlier texts did, but without looking very, very scholarly and technical, but not necessarily quite the same kind of readability, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Marketing, really.
Yes, so you look at this and you go, oh, this must, hopefully you might think, this must be important but also a pleasure to read, as opposed to, oh, did I have to go to this column? Oh, I need to look down there. Oh, I'm now thinking about which text is which rather than what is actually being said, which is what I find happens if I look at a text.
But that's dangerous because you say what is actually being said, and that's not what's actually being said. So, I mean,
there's, I know,
there is this paradox, isn't it? I mean, the text is complex. You don't even know what the text looks like. So, comparing it to a novel that you can read, you know, and it's there and it's fine, it's not that easy. I don't know, that's. I'm not trying to
put it down. Yeah, I suppose it comes back to my recreating the experience, because the medieval reader, when they picked up the text, didn't spend ages worrying about what the actual text might have been, because they just had the version in front of them that they had, and they used it. Because this is where the other part of my thesis comes in, is looking at how people in the Middle Ages in England might have been influenced by what they read in the commentary. It's almost impossible to tell which precise edition they used at any particular moment, but they were clearly reading the stuff and using ideas from it.
So in a sense, your presentation here recreates a reader experience, which may not necessarily be exactly the same in detail as any given medieval or ancient reader experience, but is at least in one sense closer to it, because it's not interrupted by the critical apparatus and all the other artifacts you get in the other texts. And so
yes, that's what I've been trying to say, and you put it much more clearly.
I like the image that you showed, the big text, probably what it was, it had the people in it and the little names of the people, and you've got
the
picture of what's going on. You've got Virgil's text, and you've got the commentary as well. Because, going back to what Charlotte was saying about the purpose of the commentary, if it's a teaching tool, it's something, they're going back to Austin's commentary on the Aeneid, it's something that you have to unpack the text as you're going through. And there's sort of different ways and approaches to doing that. One is a heavily sort of grammar-based one that explains all the grammar in it, which clearly this isn't doing. And the other sort of one is one that tells you interesting things about the text as you're going through. And in the same way that the image does, the picture that you held up there gives you another interpretation, if you like, of what's going on in the text. You've got the text, the visual representation of it, and you've got some sort of unpacking going on as an aid to understanding what Virgil is writing. And the big thing with Servius, and why I'm very pleased it's getting more attention these days, from whatever angle, is because it's been serious a lot. I mean, Servius is a lot closer to Virgil and an understanding of what was in his head and his culture.
I was just thinking that another temptation, now that you've got this, would be as a way to experiment with different kinds of layout of this, and sort of see whether they produce different effects, whether somehow one sees things differently, depending on how it's actually laid out. I was thinking right back when you showed us the printed page, because the block of Virgil was about 8 lines, I think, so. So was there an indicator as to how did you know which line you were writing?
This is, now, I'll get back to this one. I'll show you. It's, screen I've got here is really good shape as opposed to the screen that you've got.
Yeah, you've got a work screen, and that's
doesn't What you've got, above each one of Virgil's words, you've got a little letter. Yes. And the little letters will be repeated over here. And I don't know how good the quality is on this. I have fiddled with it somewhat in various bits of design packages to make it blow up. But yeah, you can see that you've got the C above the hike. There's the C. And then there's the quote. And
So there's leather as well.
Yes. Yes. Well, by the time you've got potentially, apparently, five commentators included here.
Yeah. Look, imagine the text. The text where you have Virgil in large, very clear letters, and then Servius and other commentary interspersed between. That's not so much a pleasurable reading text anymore. Even though it's been separated out in different colours, different styles, it's still the text. One who's more interested in looking at the commentary at the same time and going back and forth between the two. So that might be a text that is slightly closer to the person who's who likes the Harvard text, the Harvard layout.
And there's Bellum, that's your Bellum.
Yep, there's my Bellum.
Did he give up after that?
Sorry?
Did he give up after that and writing things on
the text? No, he's done more. He's got little pointy hands when he thinks there's an important bit.
Didn't have highlighter pens, I guess.
There's not much room for writing anymore.
He's made a little mark at the side here as well.
So is this a student reader's gloss, do you think? It's like, all our degree textbooks.
They have the English words scribbled
above them. Is this the equivalent? He's using a Latin word that he understands better than our language is.
Hey, what's the point of that? It's your lecturer saying, well, here, by all, it's a metonymy for war.
Right.
Just preparing for the exam.
I realize that you're not interested in, you're not planning to do any editing work, but within that format, or the slotted thinking about formats, do you think there would be a way of integrating information on the textual tradition?
Yeah, you can do it as links. Mm-hmm. So that you could, I've got it on this now. Okay, I'll use this page as an example. But you could hold the pointer over a certain point and have something whereby you could then bring up that link, but without necessarily interfering with the page, so that the reader who wants to read all those extra bits can read them.
I guess until sort of the 19th century, people put footnotes for manuscript variants. Mm. And now we have this thing where we have just the line numbers at the bottom of the page. It's not very satisfactory as a way of, it's very hard to read a text with line numbers, blah, blah, blah. So I just wonder why.
And certainly, once you digitize
your
text, you have to go back to footnotes.
Right.
Because you have to glue the things together.
But the footnotes don't have to appear at the bottom of the page.
They
can appear as
pop-ups.
They can come up in various ways. Yeah. And it's nice to have, sometimes it can be a mess, but you might also want footnotes that pop up and stay up there as sticky, so you can move them out of the way. But,
yes.
they're ready.
You want to be able to see both at once, otherwise you're going to wind up writing it down.
But maybe different readers will want to see different
things.
Well, I think that's the very exciting possibility, is that you could have an option. I want this option, and I'm going to have text all the way around my page.
Mm-hmm.
Or copy all the way around my text. No, I want it in the top right corner. No, I want it below. I think that would be a very exciting thing to experiment with.
Mundane citations.
And also, that would allow readers who have got the Latin and don't need the English to dispense with the English and put
all
the...
It's all about these choices. Has anyone seen these new... I just heard this advertisement this week from CUP, who are producing classical texts. Don't, it's a vast expense. The price isn't mentioned anywhere. but it's a new thing called Lectrix, and they've produced... I can't remember about six Latin texts. They're all from the green-yellow series, but they're online.
Electric at Cambridge.
Yes.
This is Tim Hill.
Yeah.
That's his name.
They've just put out a big announcement and it says prices on consultation for institutions.
Okay.
So you, or, and it's going to be based on the number of people using it, which is kind of.
All our stuff is free, it's so much easier.
But I was wondering how their actual layout
works. Yeah. He did a presentation for us. Gabby, when did Tim give his presentation? Was it last year or year before?
Before
last. No, so we don't have an AGI. Might have some.
Yeah. But I was interested. I mean, what I wonder is how imaginative people have been so far in thinking about how to express electronic commentary. I think one of the interesting things is that a lot of said for going back and looking at all the different ways that commentary can be presented, but then going back to this new medium and saying, okay, which of these kinds of methods would we like to be up to use?
One thing I'd like to mention is something that you sort of whizzed through, but a non-linear reading. You're indicating when you got onto your pages that you would start with this page, and you would sort of follow the links, and they would take you off some of the links, which I think is extremely interesting, because that's how you find out the interesting bits, right? Because otherwise you start at the beginning and sort of start losing it, you know, two-thirds of the way through. And it put me in, what I thought about through that, when somebody gave a presentation here a few years ago, not to that, remember the one that the American girl who was giving the presentation on the Book of Roland, and you didn't, it's sort of one of these saga things, and you don't start at the beginning, because it decides for you where you start, because as it's part of the oral tradition, going back to the home of places, right? So only people that read the book start at the beginning. The people who actually hear performances from rhapsodes of Homer, they get whatever they get, whatever the occasion is, a story out of the Iliad or out of the Odyssey. They don't start at the one and work their way through. And this was doing the same sort of thing. You would go to the website, you would hit on it, and it would just pop you in somewhere in a story in the middle of the Book of Roland. And then after you've read that bit, it will pop you out and it'll pop you into another one. So you wouldn't end up with a story from the beginning to end, which I thought was a great concept. And you can do something like that here, where you can follow all the important things rather than the actual story. Because, I mean, pretty much people know the sequence of the story, yeah? You get shipwrecked in Carthage, tells the story of the destroyer, goes on to find Rome. Yeah? We know what we want, the interest, what's interesting, right, without having to read all the books.
And it's certainly not very linear, but...
No, it does jump around a bit itself, doesn't it?
Are the links bi-directional? Because that's the other interesting point. I mean, in a sense, you can always follow those links yourself. You have to have the whole text going in one direction. But what you can't do is know where else in the text things are referring to what you're reading right now. So kind of going backwards in some ways provides, obviously it's not an authentic reader experience, because the authentic reader can't do that, but it might be interesting.
I've only done 3 pages, so obviously I've been able to have the bi-directional link because that's how it's been laid out, but
Yeah, that was the aspect that reminded me of biblical reading, which is also done very much by this kind of chain of associations rather than you start at the beginning and you read through to the end.
Another thing, if I can bring out, every time it goes quiet, I'm going to bring up something. That's a warning, yeah? You've got something to say, jump in. The way you were showing the different font types, I thought was particularly interesting as well. Right? And you're quite right. Examinations papers do tend to be. Actually, it's a requirement.
It's a requirement for dyslexic.
Do you know why? It's because they're easier to, the serifs interfere with the process.
It's relatively easy, that. In the last couple of years, they put it through as being an accessibility issue.
It's a crime, but sorry, what I was going on to say was I also saw, while I was introduced to this survey by one of my colleagues, Otto Christensen Saitz, and he was talking about our perception of what it is we're reading based on the font. You know what I'm going to say now, right? Oxford, OUP, and CUP, they're all printed in Times New Roman. Terribly, terribly serious. Arial isn't, right? And he gave this bunch of students the same printed in, you know, variety of fonts, right? And they had to rate it. And it's the same text, isn't it? And their rating, of course, the one that's printed in Times New Roman at the top, right?
with all the other sort of Surrey font, and the area one at the bottom, oh, that's clearly not a scholarly text, because it's in Arial, it's got no, you know, it doesn't look right. And that's, you were doing a separation there, where you had the sort of serious text in the Times New Roman, and the different fonts for the other one, and yet that is how it works. But this is why serious academic publications are still in Times New Roman, but when you go to PowerPoint, the default font is Arial, not Times New Roman, because it works better. I got missed out, guys, so sorry. that's no excuse. Yeah? I don't mind, whatever you've got in your hand. Red is good, thank you.
They're all clustering here.
Yeah, I
think
it's
good.
Do we have any more serious and direct questions?
Well, I just wonder what are you hoping to do with this? Do you have a plan? I mean, do you want to publish a kind of online article demonstrating this? Have you been trying it out just to test your own ideas?
Well, it started because I was trying out ways in which I could explain what I wanted to say in my thesis.
Yep.
And at the moment, it is simply just a tiny part of my thesis in which I explain something.
Yeah. Well, I did wonder when you might, after you submit it, I would never suggest anybody do anything before that, that what might be quite interesting would be to find a nice chunk passage with enough internal references. That you read. But I mean, the nice thing is you can download all of this stuff. You don't have to retype anything.
Oh, no.
So you could retype the text, you download the text, and play with ways in which you might, with different models of presentation, and perhaps end up with a rather interesting online publication which said, look, here are ways you can publish commentary. And go through and see what you think happens when you read it this way or that way. I think that could be an extremely interesting thing to do, including doing the techniques and markup and seeing what you could do with that. But having done so much thinking, I think it would be great to put it together like that. But, of course, I believe it's useful. These things are far too seductive otherwise.
My supervisor is listening to all of this.
I think Charlotte is quite right. I think there'll be an excellent project for after the thesis.
It's always nice to have something to pound carrot. If I finish discussing the thing, then at least then I'll be able to go on and do something interesting.
With you were very concerned about the layout, and I hardly understand why, because things positioned on a web page is problematic, so I clearly see why you've done it in the way you have. We do have a few experts in the room who might be able to advise you. Charlotte mentioned a project for later on converting into XML for web display, and you might be able to pick their brains about whether or not you can fix the positioning, maybe different bits of text in the individual page. Is that a possibility? It is.
I sometimes access the internet on a text-only browser, which kind of...
You'll never get the precision you get, even with the most advanced browsers, and CSS3 or whatever, you'll never get the precision you can get with a PDF, with something like LaTeX or whatever, you'll never get that sort of solid precision.
Also, I could choose my fonts on PDF, and I mean, the fonts I'm using are mostly Adobe fonts, which I can use within Adobe software and embed, but I can't just call up because, as you said, the end user probably doesn't have them.
Right.
One thing calling each other suggests, I think that I think would be interesting, is also for instance to propose an image, for instance, of your printed version of this online and an online version, and see how people would experience or would give you comments on these two. Because I do think that your research is very valid in looking at different formats, online and print. Doing across media
I just think that electronic publication is particularly interesting for medieval texts, precisely because they tend to be so unstable, that is, because the manuscript tradition is currently having to toss extra things in a way that they don't do with what is book texts. And it is, my experience is that it's very, very difficult to reflect effectively and in a way that isn't very cumbersome. That, and well, that's what you were saying, how do you reflect that in the second hand, or perhaps two other commentaries that have been completed in, how do you make that not just be terribly trying? How can you do that so that the information is there and available to people, but not an impediment to the reading what's there?
Yeah.
And I mean, I've endlessly wrestled with how one does these available texts, and I do think that it's a place where the electronic publication of this kind of text has contribution to make, where it might of a different sort from the contribution it made, say, to the publication of text version itself, which is, you know, pretty easy to get your hand on a very nice edition of Virgil. You don't need the work for that. You can carry out clever activities, but it's the added value is less great, but these sorts of texts huge.
Mm.